The Napoleonic Wars are so ripe for modern costume dramatists. They have all the pride, prejudice, ripped bodices, heaving décolletage, floppy shirts, tall boots, sword fights, cavalry charges, cannon fusillades, haughty manners, skinny mustaches, and mutton dinners that put modern moviegoers' butts in seats. But no one makes Napoleon movies. Every season we suffer through another spate of dreary, not my daughter, revenge bloodbaths, and bald man, car chase, hamburger, bang bang, IQ reducers, Karen wants to speak to the manager rom-coms that are neither, murder clown forever alone jackfests, and witless, groin-kicking, conspiracy humping spy movie money flushers brought to you by Zappos. Why are there not 50 Napoleonic-era sex comedy dramatainments a year? Well, let me tell you, literature, with a capital L, has got us covered. The golden age of the novel started 100 years before the golden age of Hollywood, so just as movie makers love World War II, the world of literature loves Napoleon and all he wrought. War and Peace, Les Misérables, The Count of Monte Cristo, pretty much every author from Jane Austen to Dostoevsky had a go at it. And it helped that the romantic poets suffused the whole era with dew-drenched waistcoats and tear-soaked lace, laudanum, morphine, and ambergris, such that dying of a saber wound was every young lover's dream, all the better if you were covered in epaulets. I am practically ready to join the 19th century British Navy as I sit here telling you this. And just as Hollywood keeps dropping bombs down Pearl Harbor's poor funnel stacks nearly 80 years later, so too did the Napoleonic Wars moisten the pen nibs of writers long after the swords were sheathed. No less than Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, bored to death with his dumb Sherlock Holmes, tried his hand at the genre and in the end had written Brigadier Etienne Gérard into 17 shorts, a play, and a novel. Now Gérard is a buffoon, and Conan Doyle clearly delighted in writing him into all kinds of implausible scrapes, mocking French vanity in a way that only an Englishman with a mouthful of sparrow pie and ashes can do. These are the kind of books you might find a dog-eared copy of in the head of your friend's dad's in need of varnish sailboat, or gradually foxing into dust the color of strong tea on a shelf made of beadboard in a rental house in Wellfleet. Far from the three-hour Napoleonic War epic I'm imagining, the Gérard novels are really best suited to be adapted into an episode of Benny Hill. Maybe not surprisingly, given the bawdy sex with milkmaids and slapstick sword fighting, several attempts were made to translate Gérard to film, most recently in 1970, a year renowned for its good judgment. Set in Spain, amidst the Peninsular War, where Napoleon's forces fought the British and Spanish in order to prop up his older brother Joseph, whom he'd installed as Emperor of Spain and the ultimate sibling own of history, Gérard is an idiotic young officer who believes himself to be the bravest and most capable soldier in Bonaparte's army, not to mention the Serge Gainsbourg of Portuguese haylofts. Now Napoleon picks him to ferry a decoy message with the full expectation he will fail and be captured. But like Inspector Clouseau or Maxwell Smart, Gérard falls ass backwards into success and gallantry, and the whole scheme goes ass over tea kettle, or derrière plus de casque du vin, or whatever. We need more films about Napoleonic War and sex and costumes and tall boots, and this movie has all that, but it isn't the template I would follow. It is for you, not for Spain. Today on Friendly Fire, The Adventures of Gérard. Yeah. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Uh-huh. Yeah. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing.
Welcome to Friendly Fire, the war movie podcast with the hosts that can mix daring with timidity, can be outrageous with an air of humility, and presumptuous with a tone of deference. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
And I'm John Roderick.
That's one of the lines of the film. One of the best parts, I thought.
That line?
Yeah.
Did you guys have a hard time hearing what people were saying in this film?
The sound was not great.
I have become a full-time closed caption person Friendly Fire movies.
Weird.
Yeah, I had to close caption for this one as well.
I just I did that thing. I rode the volume knob where I was like, it needs to be louder, and then all of a sudden it gets really screechy. It did not have a lot of bass in the sound. It was a lot of treble.
You know what I liked least about the presentation of this film was that you sort of wonder as you're going through. There had to be a widescreen version of this somewhere. We all watched this on Amazon. And then at the very end for the credits, they give you the scope version.
Spreads out.
Of the film that you could have been watching the entire time. Come on.
Yeah.
It's not even pan and scan. It's just cropped in.
Yeah.
And you really feel it.
We're losing like half the image.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Because the one thing this movie has going for it, one thing only, is that it's is that it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this is an era where they obviously spent a lot of money on this. They've got 100 plus extras, all beautifully costumed in Napoleonic era stuff. The sets are great. They spent a lot of money on explosions.
I just feel like Napoleon seems like a real asshole, and I don't know why the Dynamite family would name their second boy after him.
Of all the military leaders in history, Napoleon is the one that is made the most fun of, right?
Yeah, he's really good. He's characterized by Eli Wallach here as a real, just, I don't know, he's not dumb, he's just like slapstick.
You get all kinds of depictions of military leadership throughout world history in our films, and yet his is reliably like, what a dope. What a short fucking dope.
Body is too long for his legs.
The Germans hate him. The Germans hate the French. The Spanish hate the French. The English hate the French, and the French hate the French.
Was he so loathsome as a personality?
No, I don't think so.
Why?
I think he was.
What is this?
I think he was the greatest general of the modern era, and he became emperor, which is a bad look. But no, I think this is all related to the fact that my mom still calls him Bonaparte and spits on the floor.
Well, I was gonna say, like, if you're a Bonaparte, do you change your name because of the years and years of Napoleon shaming?
No, I feel like if you know, read the record. He deserves more respect.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
I mean, he got the roads, you know, drive on the right side of the road thing. That was him.
You see Hitler depicted a lot as a clown. We're starting to see Stalin depicted as a clown. There haven't been as many films, but it's starting to happen. You never see Mao or Pol Pot depicted as clowns.
You don't see a Mao clown.
No,
Mao depicted that much.
That's true. I feel like that's true. But Napoleon, we're an extra 100 years or more away from his depredations. So by the time movies came along, I guess. You know, you don't even get Robert E. Lee depicted as a clown.
Where's the cool Napoleon movie? The one that makes him into a hero and not a punchline.
When he started having himself painted with, like, dressed in togas, he opened himself up. And that's the depiction that Eli Wallach gives us here. There are several little set pieces in this movie where it's actually referencing an oil painting of the era, where Eli Wallach is clothed as Napoleon in some famous paintings and sort of arrayed, splayed across a couch or whatever,
right,
in mockery of some of the heroic art.
It feels like Napoleon isn't even the most mocked man on this film.
Everyone gets the mockery here.
Yeah. I mean, for like a British satire of the French, there's a lot of self-dunking. Mm-hmm. You know, like the British coming to war in skirts, etc.
Well, this movie is just one series of pretty ineffectual dunks after another. Like it's just a chain of dunks.
I wondered, like, so part of what's weird about this movie is that Jerzy Skolimowski, the guy that directed it, did not speak a word of English and never got a translation of the script. So he had to like direct this through an interpreter?
That can't be true.
This is one of the things that I read about the film.
Wow, that's great trivia.
I mean, it makes the film make sense because it is absolutely unintelligible what is meant to be depicted. Like from the beginning of the movie, you're thinking, is this a Japanese movie that's been dubbed? Because it makes because it makes less sense than What's Up, Tiger Lily.
I am the emissary of the emperor.
One of the things I wanted to interrogate was, to the degree that it even can be, is the idea of British comedy. Like, Monty Python began in 1969. This film was made in 1970. Was the Monty Python sense of humor a reflection of that culture, or did it create British comedy culture?
Oh, no. The British comedy culture started way, way back. You know, the Dudley Moore radio hour. I mean, Monty Python was part of a continuum, Peter Sellers and, you know, British sort of like off-ball Dada comedy.
That's what I gathered, but this very much seems like a film that could be made by no other people or culture than by those that spawned the Monty Python.
I saw a ton of Woody Allen, early Woody Allen.
Oh, interesting.
In the kind of, like each little vignette was meant to stand, none of it was furthering any kind of plot.
Mm-hmm.
The plot is like non-existent, really. But each vignette was meant to be funny with a little visual joke or a little bit of somebody slips on a banana peel. And all of that felt kind of like those early Woody Allen movies. And this is right at the beginning of that, right at the beginning of Woody Allen's filmmaking career, too.
Yeah, it's got the feel of like a Bananas where like we don't really have enough money to do any of this stuff, but we're just going to go ahead and do it.
The only thing that prevents this from being just totally insane as a story and a film is the Claudia Cardinale character.
I would argue even she does not keep this from being totally insane.
I think she and her character is the only serious part in the film.
She's certainly the only consistently like attempting to consistently be real and have a motive.
She's grounded. She's the grounding. She's grounding everything else around her in some sort of reality. And she's great.
She is great.
She is Sophia Lorening around in a way that I really appreciated.
She is. She was, I mean, this is the era of eye makeup.
Yeah.
She's got the raccoon eyes that you don't see again until 2007.
She does not think to take that off when she's attempting to dress up as a man.
It's been many years since I saw 8 and a Half, but I did not recognize her as the same woman. She's great.
This was a $3 million budget. She made $500,000 of it.
She was the star, huh?
Worth it.
Well, not worth it because the movie was still... like, the movie is a bag of beans.
No, man. I will maintain worth it because without her, what is this movie?
Still a bag of beans.
Way worse, though.
Yeah, but how...
Unwatchable worse.
It was already unwatchable.
It's watchable, I think, because of her. And also, I think Peter McHenry is totally fun. I loved his performance.
He's fun, but what does he have to work with? Like this, the script is like, the script really felt like a Mad Lib.
He is charming. He is like Ferris. He's more charming than Ferris Bueller, I think.
He's so handsome.
It is a very Ferris Bueller performance, the way he keeps turning to the camera and remarking on something he's experiencing.
Yeah.
There are a lot of good actors. Like his British counterpart, his fencing opponent, also extremely handsome. And every time he was on the screen, I felt like a brief reprieve. Like, well, at least this guy knows what he's doing. And this competition.
You're talking about Colonel Russell.
Colonel Russell. Yeah. The competition between the two seemed like believable, or at least you could get into it.
I wonder if he ever got cast in movies that Michael Caine turned down.
He did have
a Michael Caine. He was super caney.
Yeah, he was caney.
You are in a pickle, sir. You hold your doggy.
But I think part of the problem was that Peter McHenry as Colonel Gerard is playing a caricature of a dumb, callow Frenchman, but in a British accent. He didn't even bother to Peter Sellers it. So he's like fopping around, and if he had just put a little accent on it, you know, it would have been And it would have made incrementally more sense.
Yeah.
But he's like, oh, righto, good old boy. Here I am, the Frenchman.
I would never deign to parley with an Englishman.
I spit in your general direction. He doesn't even like give us that.
Yeah.
So that was a little bit, but I mean, not even in the top 10 reasons why this film is.
When you're an English production, you can't have the bad guys be speaking in English accents.
Mm.
Right, unless they're Nazis, right? If your Nazis speak British accents, that's, I guess, an established film trope. But French accents are hilarious when you try and do them. How could they have passed up? Well, it's because the director was Polish and didn't speak English.
Right.
He didn't know enough to say, like, why don't you do a funny French accent?
Probably couldn't tell the difference.
You could not tell the difference. Ah, sacré bleu.
Yeah, that's the main thing about Polish people is that they can't distinguish between accents.
It's not about Polish people, Adam. It's about you. Like, you can't distinguish between accents when it's a language you don't speak.
No, I feel it's Polish people.
Fair enough, John.
I was just being oversensitive for comedy, you know, comedy.
What?
Which is kind of my review of this film. You know, comedy. Give it a try sometime.
We're really dancing around the different casting choices in this film. I had a hard time. This is going to sound racist.
Go ahead.
I had a hard time telling the white people apart. I confused Napoleon with Milfiers.
Yeah. The characterizations of Spaniards in this film dates back to a time when Spaniards were an ethnic minority that you could mock. Now I think we think of Spaniards as being Europeans who are lumped in with all Europeans as people that Ben hates on behalf of the oppressed.
That's why it's called Lumpia.
Lumpia. But at this point in time, we really get the caricature of the, like, conniving. They're either beautiful women or they're like dark and sneaky.
With like nose
guys.
Prostheses.
Yeah, super big noses.
Yeah.
You don't see anti-Spanish racism as much as you maybe once did.
I mean, I think that the Spanish dole it out enough that they can probably take a little, right?
Oh, see, there you go. Mm. There's the anti-colonialist perspective I was waiting for. But yeah, I see what you mean. Like the, they all spoke British, they all spoke with British accents, so it was hard to even tell them. We're trying to make sense of a plot that was never fully elucidated. The plot was Napoleon was going to give Girard a message that he hoped Girard was such a fool that the message would get captured and it was disinformation. But Girard somehow bumbles through and that creates a problem for Napoleon. But in the end, by complete accident, like a crow pecks on a bag of bullets or something, and the castle
perfect
blows
comparison.
Up anyway. But none of that. Yeah, when a crow pecks on a bag of bullets.
Yeah, the thing about crows is that they always remember a bag of bullets.
They hold that grudge. They're like Adam in that way.
But none of that was clearly articulated or depicted.
Yeah, you really had to read between the lines to get what was going on at all. And I think part of what muddied that was like one of Gerard's opening moments is deciding to ride by himself into you know, mounted combat with a bunch of British horsemen and kills all of them. So you're like, oh, he is as capable a soldier as he claims to be in these voiceovers. And then the rest of the movie, he's like being a total idiot and accidentally winning.
I think that that's actually sort of at the heart of this style of book. I think that Girard in the Conan Doyle books is portrayed as a clown, except he actually, his clowniness, because he believes it, he actually behaves valorously many times. So you can't just hate him. He's not just... Well, Clouseau is the same, right? Clouseau ends up solving the mystery. And it's not just by accident. He actually does have insights.
What part of Arthur Conan Doyle's mind is he exercising with this? Because like the alt is Sherlock Holmes, who is competent.
Right.
But just as witty and interesting and cutting, like I could, like the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes films feel like they could be related to this in that smart alecky, could turn to camera in any moment kind of wink and finger gun sensibility. Like it's interesting that he makes these characters so similar in so many ways, but very different in terms of intelligence, I guess.
I feel like there's that tradition in English writing, the sort of Orwell tradition, where there's an awful lot of social criticism baked into books that are also kind of fantastical or comedic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Conan Doyle, we think of him as a sort of an adventure writer, but there's also a lot of social commentary in what he's doing. And this is a broader version of that, but he's not just mocking the French. He's using the French to mock the English. It's a good way of looking at Conan Doyle as maybe a more sophisticated author than his main character might suggest.
It's interesting how recognizable all of these traits are, given that Arthur Conan Doyle worked in the late 1800s. The book was published around then. This film was made in 1970 about Spaniards and British people, and yet these are recognizable tropes and traits about these cultures.
Right.
Did you read these books? It seemed like at the end of the last episode you were familiar.
I guess I'm familiar with a lot more books than I've read, and it's a problem of reading book criticism. Like I read a lot more film reviews than I see movies. I read a lot more album reviews than I listen to albums. I'm a fan of criticism as an independent art form.
You read a lot more reviews of our show than you participate in them?
Yeah. Certainly more than I write.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I spend a lot of time reading book reviews. And I think there are a lot of people listening to our show that have no intention of ever listening mm-hmm. to these movies, but they like hearing criticism of them. So I think it's the strongest argument that art criticism is art. So I'm familiar with these books, but not interested in them at all.
So your film paper is What We're Doing is Art?
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Whoa.
End of every show, it says artist-owned, audience-supported. We're the artists. We own this shit.
I did read Lonesome Dove. Not that that's relevant here.
Do you think this is a better book than it is a movie? I could see myself really enjoying reading these books.
Are you kidding me? This is a better gum wrapper than it is a movie.
Yeah.
There's no movie here, I don't think. What this movie feels like to me is drugs. It feels like everyone's on drugs. And this is early in the days of drugs, where people on a movie, making a movie would be influenced by drugs.
I wonder if part of that is the crop factor, though. Like, just the fact that, like, you know that there's a bunch of stuff that you can't see because they cropped this film for the television aspect ratio.
God, that is such an interesting observation. That is unintended.
Like, it just made me feel crazy the entire time. Like oh, we can see the halves of the two faces on screen that are having a conversation. Why? Just make it a wider angle.
Well, there's that, but also there's that Woody Allen element where you're in a scene where you're nominally in the Napoleonic Wars and then somebody in a dildo costume walks across the set or there's like a cow smoking a pipe. Like there,
I didn't understand all the Klan robes. I was watching this on an airplane and I felt very self-conscious that I was watching a movie where like occasionally just like 80 guys in Klan robes would wander through a scene.
You got Forrest Gumped on that airplane, Ben. I was surprised by Klan robes in my airplane experience.
You guys are so great.
Did you have to move your glassware served to you in a glass up in first class in front of the screen, Ben, to keep the one person sitting next to you from seeing what you were watching?
I was in economy with the people, Adam. Mm.
I love how consistent you are. what you are seeing is a thing known as a capriote, which is a form of hood that is used in Spain.
Friars on a pilgrimage is what it says.
They're like brotherhoods. They're like religious clans in the old sense, not in the Ku Klux sense.
Spelled with a C and not a K.
And they
how do you spell Caprio? Does that have a K?
No, it does not. it also has a C. It's like it dates back to the Inquisition. They're the groups of people that would like flagellate themselves in the streets.
Wow.
And so now in all the festivals of the saints in Spain, these sort of fraternal organizations will take to the streets in very colorful but very pointed clan looking costumes. And when you see it in person, it is no less shocking and affecting.
How much of your life is just spent paranoid about what that looks like? Like, don't go into my closet.
Well, I think,
or like you take it to be dry cleaned. Like, look, I know you think you know what this is.
This is happening.
It's a social club.
This is happening in Spain. They don't care. They don't even see it. But you know, the hoods are way taller and more pointy, and in a way, like crazy, more sinister looking, even than the. And also, they definitely wear like. The Cross of Malta. I think it's probably where the clan got a lot of their iconography.
According to the Wikipedia article, the anti-Catholic second Ku Klux Klan that arose at the beginning of the 20th century may have modeled part of their regalia and insignia on the Capriote and San Benito as a sardonic nod to the enforcement of restrictions on masquerades a century earlier.
Wow, the last time that the Klan was ever sardonic.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Not famously.
You know, right-wingers just have great senses of humor in general.
The right can't meme. Anyway, so when you spend any time in Spain or interact with Spain culturally, this is one of their it's kind of like, you know, the way New Orleans has Second Line and Mardi Gras stuff. There are a lot of festivals in Spain. Every saint has a freaking festival, and all these different groups come out and they carry statues of Christ and they pin money. It's like it's basically like The Godfather 2 meets Birth of a Nation meets.
Hold on, I need to put more paper into this printer. Paper jam, paper jam, paper jam.
John has been filing his TPS reports.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm going to need you to work on Saturday.
What the fuck is happening?
Can you enjoy a film that is based purely on its title character's charisma? Like that, I feel like that's what this film is asking you to do. Like, can you get with Gerard?
But his charisma is thwarted at every turn by the fact that he's not fully characterized. We do not see either his talent or his doofishness. Like, we get one scene of him bawling some girl in a hay loft.
Who I thought for a moment was Teresa, and I was like, wow, fast action, Gerard.
Yeah.
But it was not. It was just another raccoon-eyed, voluptuous Spanish girl.
She was very voluptuous.
Yeah. You see a lot of nude back in this movie.
Well, and I'm surprised that we didn't get more nude front given the time and place, but maybe this was just before.
Yeah, you see a lot of bush front. In the 70s. This was a bush-free movie. A piece of sky.
But no, what I wanted was this cast being employed in an actual movie.
By a director who spoke their language.
So I'll read you the quote from the director. I had never made a film that cost more than $100,000, and to make matters more ludicrous, I didn't speak a word of English, so I could never read the script. It was all relayed to me verbally by translators, but I never read a written translation. I just didn't know how to make such a film. So I decided I could either make a fool of myself or turn it into a joke on Hollywood, and I decided on the latter course. What?
Why did he get this job?
I love this guy.
In what way is it a joke on Hollywood? Like, what's the joke?
This guy is my guy for not turning down this job. Wow. That's crazy. How does anyone not stop him?
Yeah, just in case anybody's listening, I've never directed a movie with a budget over $100,000 either.
There is a budget and a lot of moving parts here.
A lot of extras, a lot of costumes.
I don't indict Jersey at all for his decision to direct the film. I'm pointing my bony fingers at the producers. Who thought this was going to be okay?
That is the story of this movie that is so much more interesting than this movie. It's obvious why they wanted to make a Gerard movie. Mm-hmm. And I think people have tried to do it. And I read somewhere that there's actually a Gerard movie in development now starring Steve Carell and Ricky Gervais.
People love Ricky Gervais.
Yeah, as Napoleon. He's Napoleon and Steve Carell is Gerard.
You could see it.
So, you know, I understand why you want to make the movie.
Napoleon was a famous atheist, right?
And I understand why the movie got made in the time that it got made. It seems like, it's time for a funny war movie, 1970. People are really laughing about war at this point. Let's take it all the way back. Let's make a sex comedy. You know, it all makes sense. It all comes to the decision that the director doesn't speak English. Why? Why? Who owed who a favor?
I mean, this is a crime that would put you in director prison forever. And Jersey went on to direct many, many films. He was in the Avengers as an actor.
The TV show?
No, the movie. The movie The Avengers, 2012's The Avengers.
Marvel's The Avengers?
Marvel's The Avengers.
Now let's tread carefully, boys.
Yeah, he's in it.
Wow.
As what? Magneto?
I mean, we know he was Georgi Lushkov. Everyone remembers Georgi Lushkov, right? He really does it all. Writer, actor, director, producer, art director, editor. He's a multi-hyphenate.
I feel like you guys enjoyed it somehow.
I have to admit that I did. I gave myself over to its insanity. Once I very early stopped trying to figure out the story, which was totally inscrutable to me. Like, I actually had to look up the film on the Google to tell me what the story was, because I didn't get it just from watching it. It was fun. It was just, it was vignette-y.
I felt like as a vignette movie, I wanted more boobs. You know, like...
That would have made me even more uncomfortable on my airplane.
At a certain point, I did something I've never done before, which is I reached over and picked up a guitar. Just started playing guitar during the film. Not so loud. It was an electric guitar, so it wasn't loud enough to drown out the dialogue. I could still follow along. But I needed something to do with my hands.
Wow. And without boobs, there was not the obvious thing to do with your hands.
Right, right.
Mm.
Maybe part of what I enjoyed about it was that we watched so many movies that are really hard for this project that it was nice to watch one that really didn't ask anything of me or of itself. And it was like a nice tight 90 minutes, you know? It was like, hey, we'll get through this pretty quick, even though it isn't anything.
It could have been 45 minutes.
Famously, we do not compare war movies to other war movies, but is there any modern film that feels like this one that would be a suitable comparison?
In the same way that there are a lot of 1970s movies that go to 3 hours, and it's not 3 hours because the scope of the story is so broad, it's 3 hours because there's an hour-long wedding scene. Or it's 3 hours just because everything just moves incredibly slowly because all the directors were artists. There are also these 70s movies that just feel like magazines, or they feel like comic books. You know, they feel like Garfield comic books, where it's just like Garfield pushes Odie off the table, and in the next one he eats a lasagna, and then he sits on John's head. It's raining outside. You know,
One he's sending Nermal to Dubai.
Shucky darn and slop the chickens.
Yeah, we've watched, of the films we've watched from this year, we've watched MASH, Kelly's Heroes, and Tora, Tora, Tora.
Those are the only four movies from 1970 we've watched?
Yeah.
Wow. What a year.
But what are the comedies we've watched? Like, The Mouse That Roared is very similar to this.
Yeah, but that was 1959. And that's funnier than this. Like, I think that one of the things that's so wild about this movie is that there are so many things that are like, huh? Huh? like they're waiting for you to laugh, but there's no actual joke in it.
Right, 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 right. They look at you and they go, huh?
It's like it doesn't understand that to make somebody laugh, you have to like actually surprise them or do something funny.
It may be a thing where some of the references are like British home company jokes or home country jokes, where it's sort of like, oh, by his mustache, we know that he's the foil, but that's not an excuse.
What's the deal with man who wears a table? Was that a thing?
Well, there you go. No. Man who wears a table.
Was that was never someone's job during this war?
That sounds like a Borat joke.
Yeah, it does. It's a Borat
joke.
There
is man wearing table.
It's a Woody Allen thing, except Woody Allen, it would have been, you know, he would have been dressed as a sperm. I mean, it's just one example of 50 things in this movie where you're like, okay, man wearing a table. And he gets into a...
Am I that gullible? Like, I saw it and I was like, well, yeah, of course, there were men wearing tables during the Napoleonic Wars.
But then they had a contest over the woman where they put her on a table with a rifle that had a cannon fuse.
That was spin the wagon wheel.
Spin the wagon wheel. She spun around, and although there were 358 degrees where that rifle could have ended up not shooting anybody, of course it came to a stop directly pointed at man wearing a table.
When I went to high school, I was never invited to spin the wagon wheel.
No.
I really feel like I missed out.
You never wore a table either.
No. Nobody wanted to run the risk that it would point at you.
Right.
But like guy wearing a table, he didn't perform any function as the table either. He was just there. Oh, no, no, no. That's not true. The general cracked eggs on his head.
Yeah, he was the egg cracker.
The reason he was there.
We are likable people. We inspire devotion.
This is an era of great costumes, and these characters are wearing great costumes.
Yeah, the hussars look dope.
Yeah.
If I could dress like that every day, I wouldn't care how hot I was. I mean, in terms of being in Spain.
Yeah, that's not an easy look to pull off in the Spanish summer.
I mean, even in a Prussian winter, I would think you'd be overdressed.
A fur hat in Spain in the summer just by itself, but then 10 zillion pearl buttons on the front of your uniform.
Gerard submerges his giant fur hat halfway through the film, and it looks great after.
It does.
Why? You dunk that fur hat into a pond, it's not going to look great ever again.
But it looked amazing. If you look at the covers of the novels, the Conan Doyle novels, they basically look like the movie poster for Conan the O'Brien. Conan.
Do you think Peter McInerney was a hunk for his day?
For sure, he's a hunk for our day.
Great looking dude. I wanted to see them get together.
Although but she seemed to be much more interested in the Englishman.
That's the thing. They set up this triangle between Russell and Gerard and Teresa.
And Russell just had, I don't know, he just had more.
I really like the parts between Russell and Gerard. All the fights that start and stop between them.
Yeah.
The breaks they need to take.
Yeah. The wonderful sort of like chivalric mockery that was happening there.
They try to agree on a different sort of competition besides sword fighting, and neither of them have compatible combat in the listed ways. Like, one knows how to box,
kick?
The other one... Yeah. That's great fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a real high watermark of this otherwise completely insane movie.
Well, and the sword fighting was good.
Yeah.
There was a really pretty decent sword fighting and great explosion.
It was dangerous feeling to see the sword fighting happen on horseback, too.
You know what was really dangerous feeling was when she rides her horse into the bullpen and is like trying to get that map off the bull's horns.
Yeah.
That was bonkers.
That was a thing where the framing I thought was really effective, because the camera just kind of didn't show her head and shoulders, didn't show her face. And so it was unclear who was such a great horse woman that they could pull this off, you know. But even when she jumps that horse into the bull ring and out, it seems like you do see her face, and it seems like her doing those stunts.
It does.
But those are great stunts.
Those are $500,000 stunts.
There are a lot of people falling off of horses, jumping over walls, and falling great distances. It seems like a production that was fairly dangerous.
Yeah, yeah, it does.
Gerard himself jumps from a cliff and lands into the saddle of a horse.
He jumps out of the hayloft and lands in his pants.
Yeah.
Which was a great stunt. I was like, why have I never tried that? That seems like, instead of doing beer bongs out of the second story window of a fraternity, why aren't frat boys jumping out of that window into their pants? Now that would be a frat prank.
I might like fraternities more if that's what they were doing.
Yeah. I mean, the war scenes, the explosions and the proximity of the explosions to the actors.
Yeah, the French camp on the outskirts of the castle that the British are firing from is just, it feels terrifyingly dangerous. It kind of reminded me of Gallipoli, the beachhead that they have in Gallipoli, that where there's shells going off all the time. And it's like, it's almost like people just accept that they're probably going to get shelled and are going about their business without caring much about it. Only in this movie, it's played for comedy.
Right. Played for comedy. You contrast it with the explosion scenes in Rambo 3, another trash fire movie, where the explosions are just happening in trenches that are clearly 50 feet from the nearest actor, and we're given like a foreshortening lens and made to think that anyone's in danger.
You know, feel free to shit on Rambo 3 all you want, and I know you will, but in terms of rewatchability...
Yeah, Rambo 3 is a better comedy than this one.
Fair.
Wow. Teresa's dad is like a count, but he's blind?
I thought that was her uncle.
That was her uncle.
Oh, it was her uncle.
Who lived in the castle that the British were in?
Part of why I felt at sea here was that I just didn't really feel like I knew anything about the French invading Spain and the British coming to Spain's aid. Like, that seems... Traditionally, aren't the Spanish and the French natural allies on account of their shared Catholicism?
Well, that is... well, and the Spanish and British definitely spent many years fighting one another in ye olden Armada times.
Yeah.
But the thing about Napoleon was a divisive figure, as you may know. But what happened in Spain was that Spain became a vassal state of the English, or I'm sorry, of Napoleon. He installed like a government that was a French, like basically a, like a Vichy state. The Bourbons were the dynasty in Spain, and he made his brother, Napoleon made his brother king of Spain. He made his cousin the king of Mexico. He just did this. He went around and he was like, okay, you're king of Spain now.
So who was the king of Spain?
That's Sting.
Okay.
So anyway, the Spanish people revolted against Napoleon, but he actually, Napoleon's brother controlled the government of Spain. So the Spanish rebelled, and the British, of course, trying to fight France on every field, aided the Spanish rebellion. These were complicated times. Right, because the British and French were fighting against one another in America too, but this is also concurrent with the War of 1812, which was the British fighting the United States, and the United States was, boy, it was a weird time. Lots to talk about when I teach my friendly fire history class.
Yeah.
We're selling tickets now.
Though we be on the far side of the Pyrenees, this horse is England.
Yes.
Contextual laughter for me.
And I think that was maybe one of the more intelligible aspects of this film, that our heroine felt equally opposed to both the French and English. Because
yeah,
she was a
she
Spanish,
didn't like either of them.
Right? She was a Spanish nationalist, or at least, you know, a loyalist to the Bourbons.
I don't understand what's bad about nationalism, then.
Well, I know, right? But she was a royalist loyalist.
Oh God!
Yeah. So even worse, because she's a countess, yeah. Right?
Right.
That's part of what. That's part of why she can be sexy.
That's my favorite Lord song. We can be royalist loyalists.
Well, I thought Royalist Loyalist was the guitar player in the Lemonheads.
I keep it up in the air. Oh, the hacky sack hit the ground.
This I would rather watch this than one of those like Norwegian productions of some sort of Valhalla.
Every time. You're going to wish you were watching one of these when one of those comes up again.
Wow. Yeah. Like, I mean, we don't compare movies and we won't, but just before we get to like the rating portion, this or Red Bad?
Yeah, this every time.
This every time? Really?
Yeah. Well, I don't know, man. This movie was really... It's so weird for me to watch a movie from 1970 that is this fun and to be this bored.
I mean, amazing that a movie that had as many Klan hoods as this felt less white supremacist than Red Bad.
It's true, but Red Bad had some, I don't know, fights, at least.
Yeah. All right, I have a feeling I know what your ratings are going to be for this one, but we need a rating system first, as constructed by me. And for The Adventures of Gerard, kind of wanted it to be bathtubs. It's not going to be bathtubs. You get a lot of people bathing in this movie.
There's some bathing.
Kind of wanted it to be a tabletop, like wearable tabletop guy. Not going to be that either. I needed something more aligned with how this film felt. And to me, that scene early on where Napoleon checks out Gerard's medals and one by one takes them off of his baldric or whatever and like throws them into the sand and then sort of taunts him with this Legion of Honor star should he be able to succeed in his mission. It feels like that scene is representative of what a viewer has to go through. Like, forget all of your past war film experience. Forget all of them. I'm going to dangle this Legion of Honor star in front of you. Should you make it through to the end of Adventures of Gerard? And so it will be from 1 to 5 Legion of Honor stars.
I just thought it was unfair that the Wookiee didn't get a Legion of Honor star at the end.
Yeah, that is unfair.
Well, should they make a 9th sequel to this film? Maybe they can correct that. A lot of ways to question the choices made in this film. A lot of reasons to dislike it. But for me, I was amused by how much it felt like a Sherlock Holmes film. And that was neat.
Hmm.
It is almost totally incoherent, but the thing that kept me interested and not strumming a guitar during was that Peter McInerney performance. I was charmed by him throughout. It made me want to see other films of his. And he is still a working actor at 80-something years old. Good for him. Claudia Cardinale's the same way, still doing the thing. I think that's great. I think the both of them are great together. I wish there were more scenes of them together. But this film is a little too much like Mr. Bean for me to like really vibe with. It's just too stupid. And for that reason, like it's the ways that I like it are outweighed utterly by the many reasons to not dig it. I'm glad I saw it the one time. I don't think it has much rewatchability. I mean, I don't know the answer to this question. Were there other Gerard films made? There were many books.
There were other films. There was one that was made. There were two, I think, that were made during the silent film era.
Oh, interesting. I'm not over this character is what I'm trying to say. Like, this film has me interested in what this whole world is.
You're
with
ready
Gerard.
For Steve Carell, aren't you?
I think I'd be up for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say if you're interested in this character, maybe go get the book, maybe skip the movie and watch a different movie or the Steve Carell version to come. I think for that reason, I'm just going to give it 2 Legion of Honor stars. Glad I saw it. Don't need to see it again. Wouldn't recommend it, but some stuff to like if you're watching it.
I will probably not remember anything about this movie in a week's time when Rob edits this audio and sends it to us to QA before we release the episode. I won't remember having this conversation. I just feel like this movie was a waste of time. I should have just read the Wikipedia article about the Napoleonic Wars and called it a day.
Wow.
1 Legion of Honor star.
I feel like this movie would be great if you turned the sound off and played it in the background at a party. Because if you were having a party and this movie was on, and say for instance you're at a party, it's a fun social party, but you're feeling weird because you're a little baked.
So it's like if you're invited to a party and you show up with Adventures of Gerard, doesn't really matter.
No. No, if you're baked at a party and are feeling weird and Adventures of Gerard is on with the sound off, you could go sit on the couch and plausibly be watching it where you're actually just like not making it. You're not cutting it at the party, but you're baked and you're watching this movie, and it would be like,
this is a good movie to not freak out at.
Right. You'd be grateful that this movie was on.
Yeah.
If you were at a party, and because with the sound off, it's going to make as much or more sense than with it on.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have something to do at the party. Also, if you're at the party and you are succeeding, you're like talking to somebody interesting and you're having fun and you looked over at this movie going, it would make the party seem even more fun.
Right.
Because every time you looked over, it's not like Zulu where you look over and and war scenes where people are actually getting hurt. It's like, it's like a fancy dress party with some explosions.
The bloodiest thing is when he gets a little cut on his eyebrow because he wants to have scars to remember the war by.
Right. So those are the redeeming qualities of this film. It's a great, turn the sound off and have it going in the background of your
party. Watch it for health reasons, mental health reasons. That's what you're saying?
Get a little baked, turn the sound off and put it on while you make dinner. But otherwise, it's a one Legion d'honneur.
Wow.
Star. Legion d'honneur.
I feel like it's one thing to give a low score. It's another to say that it was a waste of time. Do you also feel like it was a waste of your time?
I mean, I was drumming my fingers on my guitar rather than, because my mind needed one more thing.
Hmm.
I mean, I needed one more thing, and I couldn't play solitaire because my eyes had to be occupied.
Yeah.
Yeah, because half the characters are speaking French. You got to read those subtitles.
It was a failure.
Wow. Well, I mean, tough but fair, I guess. Was your choice of guy in keeping with that sensibility? Who's your guy, John?
I mean, my guy has to be Jerzy Skolimowski, the director of the film. Because
I should have gone first.
What a hero.
Yeah.
I mean, what a hero to have just thrown the frog at the wall like he did.
Not all heroes speak the language.
Because he wrote, he clearly in subsequent interviews said this was nuts. He didn't lobby for it.
Yeah.
Clearly he got this as some kind of work release or like he came to England seeking political asylum, and they were like, great, here's what
we're
you have to do.
We need you to do something first.
Yeah, that's
$3 million budget and a bunch of actors, go.
Anyway, he's my guy. I don't think there's another guy in the film.
My guy is Jerzy Skolimowski. having taken one or two directing jobs where I was in over my head, you know, lack of game, respect, lack of game.
Wait a minute. You know, I just realized looking at the Wikipedia entry, the producer of this film, also Polish, Gene Gutowski, who produced a lot of Roman Polanski movies, to give Ben something to think about. So somehow I feel like Gene Gutowski was behind the hiring of Jerzy Skolimowski.
Gene Gutowski is complicit in all of this. Yeah.
Gene Gutowski was like, well, I like this guy. I mean, he hasn't raped a child, but I feel like he could direct.
And wait a minute. The cinematographer is Witold Sobieczynski.
A lot of good Polish names in this.
Something's going on here. Something's not right.
Hmm.
Well, a director has to be able to communicate with their DP, so I understand.
Right.
They must be Polish.
Right. They were over there trying to screw in a light bulb.
Yeah, let's make it unanimous. My guy's going to be Jersey also. That story's too good to forget.
Yeah. Sorry to anybody that watched this ahead of the podcast this week.
Couldn't warn you off.
Yeah.
At least it wasn't a huge investment. Nice, tight 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
What do we have coming up on the next episode, though?
Maybe we'll get another comedy. Here we go. Rolling the 120-sided die. Number 24.
This week's roll landed on a 1961 film directed by J. Lee Thompson, starring David Niven, Anthony Quinn, and Gregory Peck. It's The Guns of Navarone. Friendly Fire is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Ben Harrison, Adam Branica, and John Roderick. The show is produced by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is War by Edwin Starr, courtesy of Stone Agate Music. And our podcast art is by Nick Ditmore. Friendly Fire is made possible by listeners like you. And if you'd like to make sure that the show continues, please head on over to MaximumFun.org/join. Once you pledge your support, you'll receive all of the Maximum Fun bonus audio content as well as our monthly pork chop episode. If you'd like to talk about this episode on social media, please use the hashtag FriendlyFire or join one of our online discussion groups on a platform like Facebook. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR. Adam is at CutForTime. John is at John Roderick. And I'm at Rob K. Schulte. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Friendly Fire.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.